Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the 21st day of July, 2022. I'm your host, Mark Call. Let's start off our look at what's going on around the nation and the world today with another indication that the meltdown and worldwide collapse does seem to be getting a little bit of a push. This is from Ethan Huff at Natural News, and it begins by noting that almost immediately after Russian energy giant Gazprom announced that they can no longer guarantee any further gas deliveries to Europe, how much is still open to question, Canadian energy firm TC Energy declared its own force majeure for the Keystone pipeline here in the United States. Now, this is not the one that the Biden Fuhrer shut down on day one. That would be Keystone XL. This one, although it has a similar name to that Keystone XL pipeline that was shut down the first time, as it turns out, by the Biden Fuhrer's puppet master, Barry Sotero Sabarco Hussein Obama. But this one does start in the same place, Hardisty, Alberta. And all of these operations do seem to have a strangely similar goal, choking energy supplies to those places that need them when they need them most. TC Energy claims that it's a, quote, non-operational incident resulting from third-party damage, whatever that means, and it won't affect the safe operation of the pipeline. It'll just be a major impact on capacity. And you could probably guess this, repairs are underway, but a timeline for full-service restoration is not available at this time. And if your increasingly cynical host had to guess, folks, I might suggest maybe sometime after the midterm elections. Unless, of course, World War III causes another force majeure incident before that. Ethan Huff does leave us with a bit of humor, though, noting that the trend of companies simply declaring force majeure to wriggle out of otherwise binding contracts has a lot of people wondering, hey, why can't we do the same thing? I declare force majeure on all of my bills, jokes someone over at Zero Hedge. And why is it that all of these companies, rail companies, fertilizer companies, and petroleum refineries all over the world are doing it right now? Just maybe there's an ongoing and relentless attack against not just the food supply, we've seen that one for a while now, but energy too. I guess you'd have to be a crazy coincidence theorist not to recognize that there's a pattern here. This next piece comes from investigative reporter John Solomon, and it really does demonstrate one more time that at least a major portion of the real conspiracy theories were true all along. In the final hours of the Trump presidency, he begins, the U.S. Department of Justice, and it's properly pronounced Just Us for reasons that this again demonstrates, raised privacy concerns to thwart the release of hundreds of pages of documents that President Donald Trump had declassified in order to expose FBI abuses during the Russia alleged collusion probe. And the agency then defied a subsequent order to release those materials after redactions were made, according to interviews and documents. And now the previously untold story of just how those highly anticipated declassified materials never managed to become public is contained in a memo obtained by Just the News from the National Archives that was written by then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows just hours before President Trump was, expelled from an office that it turns out he had actually won, if the election had been honest, at noon, January 20th, 2021. Meadows' memo confirmed prior reporting by Just the News that on January the 19th of that same year, President Trump declassified a binder of hundreds of pages of sensitive FBI documents to show how the Bureau used informants and FISA warrants to spy on the Trump campaign and then misled both a federal court and Congress, hey, no surprise here, about flaws in that evidence that they offered to get approval for an investigation that they knew was bogus all along. The declassified documents included transcripts of intercepts made by the FBI of Trump aides, a declassified copy of the final FISA warrant approved by the so-called intelligence court, and the tasking orders and debriefings of the two main confidential human sources, some would say co-conspirators, Christopher Steele and Stephen Halper, that the Bureau used to investigate, sick, whether or not Trump had colluded with Russia to steal, no, not the 2020 election, the one that actually wasn't stolen because Dominion couldn't rig enough votes, and this was before they had at least 2,000 mules to do the really dirty work of making the copies and stuffing the ballot boxes. In the end, it says multiple investigations found there was no such collusion and that the FBI violated rules and misled the FISA court in an effort to what? Commit treason? Keep the probe going is how this phrases it. The key takeaway is that the documents Trump declassified never saw the light of day, and of course the American people never saw them either, even though they were lawfully declassified by the president, and the DOJ was instructed by that president, through Mark Meadows, to expeditiously release them after redacting so-called private information as necessary. His memo said, I am returning the bulk of the binder of declassified documents to the Department of Justice, including all that appear to have a potential to raise privacy concerns, with the instruction that the department must expeditiously conduct a Privacy Act review under the standards, there's a concept, that the Department of Justice would normally apply, redact material appropriately, and release the remaining material with redactions applied, he wrote. And guess what, folks? You know darn well, it never happened. Just the News obtained the memo after going to the Trump collection at the National Archives and asking them to look for the binder of documents Trump had declassified. And the archives claimed they did not possess the documents. The Justice Department did, and they provided that copy of Meadows' memo to prove it. In a Tuesday night interview on a Just the News, Not Noise TV show, Meadows said he was dismayed that the DOJ ignored a lawful instruction from a sitting president and said all of this was part of a larger dynamic in which the permanent federal bureaucracy repeatedly tried to undercut the duly elected president to protect itself. Well, you know, said Meadows, the swamp is pretty deep. And when Trump got there, he added, he realized not only was the swamp very deep, but that they would fight back. And now, folks, we know that they're willing to commit mass murder to stay in power, too. On just about every front you can imagine. Liz Harrington, Trump's spokeswoman, told Just the News that the DOJ's failure to release the memos fits a pattern of political abuse inside an agency that was supposed to be above politics. And yeah, how's that for a laugher? The Just Us Department and the FBI both declined a request for comment. And former Pentagon Chief of Staff Kash Patel, who worked as Chief Investigative Counsel for the House Intelligence Committee when it unraveled the false Russia narrative under then-Representative Devin Nunes, said Tuesday that the DOJ's defiance of a lawful presidential order not only compounded the FBI and department's failings during the original probe by preventing the American public from having transparency, but of course they also, interjects your host, compounded their various criminal acts. And further, their hypocrisy, he said, is on full display. Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch, referencing some of the lawsuits that they've got in progress concerning this cover-up, noted that the DOJ, quote, did the runaround to try to protect themselves from being exposed because the documents, to be clear, relate to the improper targeting of Trump and his associates that we know is based on politics and animus as opposed to national security or anything substantive. And in the end, he continued, what the FBI came up with was a lie. Former Trump advisor David Bossie, head of the Citizens United watchdog group now, said that the episode is a pointed reminder that the permanent bureaucracy in Washington just wields too much power when it can thwart the actions of a duly elected president. And this, he said, is what President Trump ran against, the deep state. These are deep state actors that the American people don't understand, really, what it's about. But it's the people who are the permanent class in Washington. They don't do what they're told. They don't do what they're ordered to do, and so when President Trump says to a bunch of bureaucrats to go do something, they sit on their hands, especially at the last minute, unquote, especially when they believe that the election rigging is going to save them. Said Bossie, this was a conspiracy against the president within our own government. Finally, the story ends with Mark Meadows, who says if or when the documents are finally released, they'll provide compelling evidence that the Democrats and FBI, who assured the public about Russia, and the so-called conspiracy, knew they were lying. In fact, folks, it was a projection. They accused the president of doing what they knew blankety-blank and well they were guilty of, and how many times do we have to see that big lie being repeated? Well, if you've been paying any attention to the scam on Capitol Hill, the new House committee engaged in un-American activities, also known as the J6 liars, you know exactly what we're talking about. And so, by the way, does even Alan Dershowitz, not a guy that I'm a big fan of, but occasionally he gets one more or less right, appearing on Newsmax TV, the legal icon, claimed that the January 6th report will be what we all know it is, a work of fiction. Quote, it's not a real congressional committee, he told Sean Spicer. As you know, every congressional committee that we remember, even the McCarthy committees, had people on the other side who could cross-examine. This is not a real committee, he continued. This is a kangaroo committee. It only has opponents of Donald Trump and all of his advisors. Due process for thee, but not for me, isn't justified, he added. And therefore, continued Dershowitz, I don't think that the January 6th committee's report will have the kind of credibility, now listen to this carefully, the kind of credibility that the 9/11 Commission report, for example, had. Unquote, and ironically, folks, we know the 9/11 Commission was a bald-faced work of fiction, too, to the point where it even offended the laws of physics. So maybe he's actually right. even if unintentionally. Still, any way you slice it, this is far, far worse. And if you understand the logical connection here, you realize that both of these so-called committee reports were not only works of fiction, but acts of treason to boot, because they're lies in support of a continued warfare on the American people and the rule of law. And all of that, your host suggests at this point, serves as a great introduction to a really in-depth piece from Sundance at the Conservative Treehouse entitled The J6 Motive, Why These People Wanted Donald Trump Removed and the Political Surveillance of American Citizens. And he begins with some history, noting that Barack Hussein Obama and Eric Holder, Mr. Fast and Furious, held in contempt of Congress himself, but never SWAT-teamed, you might recall, did not create a weaponized DOJ and FBI. The institutions were already weaponized by the misnamed Patriot Act. But what Obama and Holder did was take that pre-existing system and retool it so the weapons of government only targeted one side of the political continuum. And this is where many Americans get understandably confused. And in the era immediately following 9/11, the D.C. National Security Apparatus, a.k.a. the Swamp, instructed by Vice President Dick Cheney, was constructed to preserve continuity of government. There's a term you ought to get used to. And simultaneously view all Americans as potential threats. The Department of Octung Homeland Security and the Office of the DNI, Director of National Intelligence, were created specifically for this purpose. And after 9/11 of Aught-1, the electronic surveillance system, originally created, allegedly at least, to monitor threats from abroad, was retooled to monitor threats from inside the country, which is when all of our electronic metadata came under federal surveillance. And that inflection point, writes Sundance, and what followed was exactly what Ed Snowden tried to point out. What Barack Hussein Obama and Eric Holder did with that new construct was refine the internal targeting mechanisms so that only their political opponents became the target of this new national security system. I'll say it one more time. Tricky Dick was a piker, folks, and Watergate a joke compared to these evil satanic minions. The problems we face as a country, suggests Sundance, are directly an outcome of two very distinct points that were both merged by Barack Obama. Number one, the post-9/11 monitoring of all electronic communications of American citizens. And number two, Team Obama creating a fine-tuning knob that had focused on the politics of the targets. And all this, he says, is very important to understand as you dig deeper into this research outline. Washington, D.C. created the modern national security apparatus immediately and hurriedly, although the foundations had long been laid, after 9/11/01. The Department of Octung Homeland Security came along in 2002, and within the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, the ODNI was created. So when President Barack Hussein Barry Sabarco Obama and Attorney General Evil Eric Holder arrived a few years later, these newly formed institutions were viewed as opportunities to create a very specific national security apparatus that would focus, like a laser, almost exclusively against their political opposition. Again, Tricky Dick's enemies list? Nothing by comparison. The pre-existing Federal Bureau of Instigation and Department of Just Us were then repurposed to become two of the four pillars of a domestic national security apparatus, a domestic surveillance state. However, this new construct would have a targeting mechanism based on political ideology. If you're not far left, in other words, you need dying. The DHS, ODNI, DOJ, and FBI have become the four pillars of this new institution, and atop these is where you will find the fourth branch of government. We weren't sleeping when all this happened, he writes. We were wide awake. However, we were stunningly distracted by the economic collapse taking place in 2006 into 2007 when the engineers behind Obama started to assemble the new design. By the time Obama assumed office in 2009, we sensed something profound was shifting, but we could only see exactly what shifted in the aftermath. Those four pillars were put into place, and a new fourth branch of government was quietly created. And as time passed, these system operators became familiar with their new tools. Technology allowed the tentacles of the system to reach out and touch us. And this is when we first started to notice something very disconcerting was happening. Those four pillars are at the root of it, and if we take the time to understand how this fourth branch originated, questions about the current state of perpetual angst will start to make sense. And at this point, even though he spends page after page going into the details, Sundance reminds us it's not his intent to outline the entire history of how we got to this place where the intelligence community now acts as the superseding fourth branch of government, because that would be way too exhausting. Still, though, history has provided us plenty of warnings, from Dwight D. Eisenhower and his military-industrial complex warning, to JFK's warning about the CIA, to Richard Nixon and the FBI, to all of the modern versions of warnings and frustrations from HPSCI Devin Nunes and ODNI Rick Grinnell. And while none of these reference points are invalid, and they're all likely true, we get lost if we focus too much on things that happened before that infamous date, 9/11/01, when the oversight or check and balance in what was once our system of government under a constitution became functionally obsolete. And here he goes on to talk about what some call compartmentalization, or containment of information. Essentially, he writes a formal process to block the flow of information between agencies and the original branches. While it's frustrating to discover, this silo effect was important because understanding the communication between networks leads to our ability to reconcile the conflict between what we perceive and what's actually taking place. And at this point, Sundance says he's going to explain how the intelligence branch works. Number one, to control every other branch of government. Number two, how it functions as an entirely independent branch of government with no oversight. Number three, how and why it was created to be independent from such oversight. Number four, what the current mission of the IC branch is. And most importantly, five, who operates it. And understand that none of the people operating deep inside the intelligence branch were elected, and our elected representatives genuinely do not know how the system works. I say this affirmatively because I've talked to House and Senate staffers, including the chiefs of staff from multiple committee seats. They're not malicious people. However, they are genuinely clueless about things that happen outside their silo. We pick up the story here, he says, in April of 2016, when the FBI launched a counterintelligence operation against presidential candidate Donald Trump. And here he provides video evidence, courtesy of New York Representative Elise Stefanik, in March of 2017. About 11 months later, to make a number of points. First, notice how FBI Director James Comey matter-of-factly explains that no one outside the DOJ was informed about their FBI operation. Why? Because, well, that's just the way things are done. The sensitivity of the matter. And notice how he claims, he shares his perspective, that informing the NSC is the same as notifying the White House. And they bear no responsibility to brief the chief executive. As long as they tell some unknown, unelected bureaucratic entity inside the NSC, their unwritten responsibility to inform the top of their institutional silo is complete. Furthermore, the video of James Clapper in that same section highlights how the ODNI position ended up becoming the fulcrum for the modern weaponization and is now an office manipulated by agencies with a vested interest in retaining power. Factually, he says, and this seems important, the modern intelligence apparatus uses checks and balances in their own favor. The checks create silos of proprietary information, classified information, vaults of information that work around oversight issues. These silos, which include the exploitation of the FISA court, are also part of the problem. And note, ironically, that the ODNI was created in the aftermath of 9/11, supposedly to eliminate the silos of information which they felt led to a domestic terrorist attack that could have been prevented. Ironically, we now know, repeats your host, that was the whole point. And what we have is a central hub of intelligence information inside the executive branch where the CIA, NSA, DOD, DOS, and DIA could deposit their unique intelligence products and a repository created so that domestic intelligence operations like the DOJ and FBI could access them when needed to, allegedly anyway, analyze threats to the U.S. Yeah, we now know what kind of threats they're really analyzing and how that information is being used. And, of course, the problem is the DNI office also created an unconstitutional surveillance system of the American people, which arguably, folks, was the real intent to begin with. But as your host puts it, this compartmentalization allowed some of the folks involved in that process to fool and blindside the others. Writes Sundance, the illegal and unlawful nature of these surveillance created a need for careful protection amid the group who operate in the shadows of electronic information and domestic surveillance. You'll see how it was critical to install a person uniquely skilled in being an idiot, James Clapper, into that willfully blind role while intelligence operatives worked around the office to assemble the intelligence branch of government. And here Sundance goes into some detail about a whole lot of parts to the process that really matter. For example, the last federal budget that flowed through the traditional budgetary process was signed by George W. Bush in September 2007, and every budget since then has been a fragmented process of continuing resolutions and individual spending bills. Why does this matter? Because many people still think that defunding the intelligence community might be a solution. It's not. Because these corrupt divisions deep inside the intelligence system can now fund themselves from multinational public-private sector partnerships, like banks, corporations, and foreign entities. And gee, folks, have you noticed just how woke and ultimately over-the-top politically correct some of these public-private partners have since gotten? Anyway, he says, there has never been a budget passed in the normal or traditional process since September 2007. People behind Obama are now pulling the puppet strings of the senile Joe Biden. And this is important. The second larger Obama holder objective was control over the FBI. Why? Because the FBI does the domestic investigative work on anyone who needs or holds a so-called security clearance. And the removal of security clearances could be used as a filter to further build the internal ideological army they were assembling. And with the power the ODNI now has, as a downstream consequence of the Patriot Act, new protocols for U.S. security clearances were easy to justify. And here's the key. Carefully selecting fellow ideological travelers was facilitated by this filtration within the security clearance process. And how does that manifest? Well, just look around and see how politicized every single so-called intelligence agency has become, especially including the FBI. And at the same time that was going on, behind the smokescreen, the Department of State intelligence apparatus began working on their first steps to align big tech with their domestic institutional objective. If you remember Arab Spring or Islamist Spring, remember it was triggered by Barack Obama's speech in Cairo, his first foreign trip. And why does all this matter? Well, you might remember how much effort the Obama regime put into recruiting Twitter and Facebook as resources for the various Mideast rebellions that the White House and Department of State supported, which was the point of the modern merge between the U.S. intelligence community and big tech socialist media. From there, Sundance goes on to talk about the details of moves by the likes of Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and evil nutcase Nancy Pelosi, and a whole bunch of other names you know very well, including the Gang of Eight, which allegedly puts intelligence oversight on both political parties in Congress, but in fact was usurped during the Obama regime years. And if you watch carefully what Comey said on that fateful day in March of 2017, it was the usurpation of the entire reason that the Gang of Eight supposedly exists, to eliminate the potential for political weaponization of the intelligence community by the executive branch. The G of Eight notifications to the majority and minority are specifically designed to make sure that what James Comey admitted to doing was never supposed to happen. Team Obama carried out a political operation using the intelligence community, and the checks and balances in the system were intentionally usurped. That, he says, is an indisputable fact, but worse still, the entire legislative branch of Congress, which then specifically included Republicans, sick, that at that time controlled the House and Senate, did nothing. They just ignored what was openly admitted, and that usurpation, again, was willfully ignored. So the mechanism that the G of 8 was supposed to prevent was bypassed without a twitch of condemnation or investigation, because the common enemy was Donald Trump, which, he says, highlights the collapse of the system. Obama, the executive branch, collapsed the system by usurping the process. In essence, the process itself became the bigger issue, and the lack of immediate legislative branch reaction became evidence of open acceptance. The outcomes of the usurpation played out over the next 4 years, as Donald J. Trump was kneecapped and literally lost his presidency because of it. However, the bigger issue of that collapse still exists. During Trump's term, writes Sundance, that weaponization was covered up by a compliant Congress, complicit Senate Intelligence Committee, and not a single member of the so-called oversight called it out. Now, Obama Team 3 steps back in to continue the cover-up and the weaponization. And note that there are only two members of the original Gang of Eight that have been in place since January 2007, Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell. And lest you think that this problem is unique to Fourth Reich America, multiple nations have that same issue. In fact, the so-called Five Eyes database run by NSA includes most of the English-speaking countries that are also suffering similarly. And in June, notes Sundance, the biggest public-private partners, Gulag, Twitter, Microsoft, and Facebook, all announced their complicity to surveil and, yeah, control the world. And now it's becoming clear what H.R. 4350 is all about. To eliminate even any pretense of oversight, including the domestic use of the military as well. If you don't like it, especially if you think you might want to speak up against it, you're a domestic violent extremist. And now it's about far more than just controlling speech. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.